Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
A proposal that has now been on the table for more than a week, a proposal that the U.S. has been urging Hamas to take. Now, our understanding of the most recent iteration of this proposal is that Hamas would agree to the release of 33 hostages from the so-called humanitarian category. So that is women, it is children, it is the elderly, it is people with serious medical conditions.
That's MSNBC reporting on this alleged ceasefire proposal accepted by Hamas. The proposal comes from Egypt and Qatar. This happened just a few hours ago. But as we are hearing the story, nobody knows what's in this proposal, neither Israel nor the United States. We're hearing that Israel does not accept the proposal because it doesn't actually meet or connect with what has been discussed prior. And what MSNBC is reporting here might not actually be the case. Tony Katz today. Good to be with you. David May joins us right now from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, research manager, senior research analyst, covers Israel and sanctions along with the financing of terrorist organizations. Let's start with the basics, David. I appreciate you having the time. This proposal, this accepted ceasefire by Hamas via Qatar and Egypt, is this anything that has been discussed previously with Israel or the United States?
Thanks for having me. As you mentioned, and as the links were saying, this is Hamas accepting a ceasefire, not the ceasefire that they were discussing. So Israel doesn't know what's on the table. And what we really have, rather than Hamas agreeing to halt hostilities against Israel, is a deception. It's a media campaign to get Israel being seen as the aggressor, Israel not agreeing to a ceasefire, but Israel doesn't know what Hamas is proposing. It hasn't seen it yet.
So the idea that MSNBC is saying that this is something that has been in the works, they're misinformed or they're engaged in real projection here?
So this is just what I'm hearing from media reports and from the Israelis, that they haven't heard. They don't know the details. But really what it seems to be is a lot of the international media falling for Hamas's strategy. Hamas is trying to present Israel as the aggressors, saying that Israel is rejecting a ceasefire. But the ceasefire that Hamas agreed to is not the one that they were discussing. From what I saw from the reports of the negotiations, the two sides were still pretty far apart in terms of their mutual demands. And so Hamas all of a sudden saying that it has a ceasefire that it will agree to, it doesn't seem to be the same one that Israel was working with.
Talking to David May, research manager, senior research analyst at the Foundations, Foundation for Defense of Democracies. To your experience, you have an MA in international affairs. You're talking about international economics and the Middle East from the School of International Service at American University. You study these things on a daily basis. To your knowledge base, to your experiences, how much of this is a head fake, knowing that Israel's already started the bombing campaign in Rafah that has been the big part of contention with Joe Biden, with Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, that it's a humanitarian issue, even though Hamas hides behind women and children? How much of this was to try and prevent Israel from furthering this campaign and to try and get them to stop while they move weaponry, move hardware, and move people?
Yeah, everything you said was exactly right. Hamas is feeling the pressure, especially after they conducted an attack on the Kerem Shalom crossing, where Israel was facilitating aid into Gaza. And they conducted that attack actually from Rafah, the last part of the Gaza Strip that Israel has yet to conquer, a bastion of Hamas. So Hamas is feeling the pressure. And in order to deflect the pressure and prevent Israel from achieving its objectives, they are trying to shift the narrative rather than focusing on the Israeli planned offensive. They're trying to make it seem as though there's a peace deal in the works. But I think the biggest takeaway that we can understand from all this is that Hamas responds to pressure. As much as they've said that they will refuse to negotiate so long as the hostilities are underway, they clearly are feeling the pressure. And the only way to force Hamas into a deal that will help Israel achieve its objectives, free the hostages, and remove Hamas as a threat is through pressure, and if not the actual military force, then at least the credible threat, which had been removed so long as the administration was preventing Israel from entering Rafah.
Before I let you go, we know that the White House, they were planning the White House briefing, White House press gathering there, Corinne Jean-Pierre, the White House press secretary, and, of course, John Kirby, who was always seen now, National Security Communications Advisor. And now they delayed it, and they're going to address this alleged ceasefire proposal now. Is this White House in a place to state plainly and clearly that Hamas is throwing a head fake here, if indeed they are, or will they make anything sound like it is up to Israel to now act in good faith, even if it's a bad plan?
I mean, that's a great question. I think it would be incumbent upon the administration, so long as it is proven that Hamas that Israel doesn't have the details of this agreement, that it is not the agreement that they were working on before. If that pans out, then the administration should surely make note of that and, you know, back Israel in terms of not trying to force it into some agreement that would clearly favor Hamas over its ally Israel.
David May, I appreciate you taking the time. Research Manager, Senior Research Analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, FDD.org. You can follow David on X at David Samuel May, M-A-Y. Follow him there. I appreciate you taking the time. I've got more to get to. I'm Tony Katz. We can take all the hard lessons, that little loving, and turn them into blessings. Don't complicate it. Just work hard and be nice to people. I was very taken by this commentary from Senator Tom Cotton. He was on ABC this week, the Sunday show, and he is talking about the Speaker, Mike Johnson.
Well, first off, I want to say I think Speaker Johnson is doing an outstanding job. I agree with President Trump on that. I agree that we need to have unity in our party right now as we face off against Joe Biden and the Democrats. And the legislation that the House passed and that we passed after the House was not just about Ukraine. It was also supporting Israel and supporting Taiwan, taking actions like making sure TikTok has to, or TikTok's parent company has to divest, new sanctions on Russia, the ability to take Russian assets to support the Ukraine war effort in the future. So it was a vital piece of national security legislation. The large majority of Republicans supported it, and I think you're going to see the large majority of Republicans back Speaker Johnson next week as well.
But now, what makes this interesting is that I believe that this is a very purposeful statement to try and blunt Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene and Representative Thomas Massie from going forward with the motion to vacate. Tony Katz. Tony Katz today. What's going on, everybody? I'm waiting to see Corinne Jean-Pierre and John Kirby take the podium at the White House. They are going to brief on this so-called ceasefire deal that Hamas has accepted that no one knows what's in it or who proposed it. It came from the Qataris and the Egyptians. When? Based on what conversations? There's a lot we don't know. But that you send Tom Cotton out there, you didn't send John Thune, more establishment guy. You didn't send Mitch McConnell himself. You didn't send Senator Todd Young of Indiana. Tom Cotton defending Speaker Johnson. That's some strong you-know-what. That is a very, very strong statement. And this is John Carl trying to push back.
But actually, in the House, a majority of Republicans voted against it. And
well, about two-thirds of House Republicans said they wanted to support Ukraine in one way or another, even if they didn't support that specific piece of legislation. It was a much smaller majority that voted to cut off aid entirely. So Speaker Johnson has about two-thirds of his entire conference behind him on that specific issue, and almost all of them behind him on the question of Israel or Taiwan, for instance, unlike the Democrats, who are deeply divided about Israel's war of survival against Hamas in Gaza.
That is as full-throated as one gets. Not only a defense of what the speaker did in putting out the separate pieces of legislation, I would have done the southern border first. I mean, it's that important. But it's not only a full defense of that, it is a statement about where he's kind of repositioning the Republican Party. Well, the Republican Party has always favored this. If you are Marjorie Taylor Greene, that's a now you have to rethink, because Tom Cotton isn't doing that of his own volition. Now that is not a knock on the senator. I've never spoken to the man. We should get him on the show. I'd enjoy the conversation, but there's nobody, absolutely no one, who is going to tell me that they have ever referred to Senator Tom Cotton as a rhino. That has never, ever, 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 ever happened. That's a bad spot for Marjorie Taylor Greene to be in if she wants to take on the speaker. He's not doing enough. He's not conservative enough. No. He's the problem. He's the issue. And he's got to go because we owe it to the American people. We owe it to our constituents. That just got a lot harder to do. A lot harder. Then you have Tom Cotton talking about this alleged deal here. This alleged deal between Hamas and it's not, I shouldn't say it's a deal between Hamas and Israel. I shouldn't say it like that. Hamas is claiming they accept a ceasefire resolution, but it comes from the Qataris and the Egyptians. Senator Tom Cotton.
Well, Jillian, we'll have to see exactly what Israel says they received from Hamas, but this sounds suspiciously like an info operation trying to win a PR war, because Hamas knows it can't win a military war against Israel, nor can you negotiate with them in good faith. As you said, we don't even know how many of the hostages remain alive. We hope most of them do, but I think we have to accept the reality that many or even most might already be dead. Hamas won't even provide proof of life photos or videos. It would not be hard for Hamas to put today's newspaper in front of these hostages and have them speak a few words into the camera, but then that would reveal their ace cards, how many hostages they still have alive. And Hamas is not going to do that, and they're especially not going to do that as long as Joe Biden continues to pressure Israel to give Hamas what it wants more than all, which is its continued existence.
Which is, of course, the name of the game. Continued existence is the name of the game here. So now you've got two plays. Tom Cotton talking strong on Israel, right? And really breaking down the reality. But Cotton defending Mike Johnson. Now you're Marjorie Taylor Greene. You said you were going to do this. You have your own constituency to deal with. As I have said before, everyone is the Mao of their own digital fiefdom. You've got your base. You've got your supporters. This is your money coming in. Are you going to let them down? Are you not going to move forward on a motion to vacate when you told them you would? You've got the president supporting Mike Johnson. Now you've got Cotton coming out and saying it. That's a hard one. That is a real hard one to do. And now the other side, let's say she doesn't. Now she doesn't do the motion to vacate. Hey, we're going to try and vote out the speaker. So now anything she says is bluster? If she doesn't do it, she's sidelined for the rest of the election year, right? Aside from support of Trump, she is sidelined on anything happening in the House. She got shut down. I don't know if that's good for her brand. She's got an election to contend with as well. That all politics are local. This is a recording. Meanwhile, U.S. automakers having an issue in China. China, of course, has been working very, very hard on creating its own ability to manufacture a host of things. Doesn't matter what they steal, right? That part is completely inconsequential. They'll steal whatever it is they possibly can. But what they've got is American technology, American know-how, because they steal it all. The U.S. has done well in the world of car manufacturing, selling in China. More and more people had dollars. Well, you see, that's because communism works. Sure, kitten. And they've bought U.S. vehicles. Things are crazy popular. U.S. vehicles in China. And brands that are, you know, Buick, things like that. Well, GM lost $106 million during the first quarter in China. And you say, oh, well, it's a fair amount of money. It's really fascinating. In the last 15 years, there have only been three quarters. In the last 15 years, where General Motors has lost money in China, which means one quarter every 3 months out of every 5 years, they lose money. That's a pretty good market. That is some strong stuff, kitten. China has never had the opportunity until now to try and sideline American vehicles. But of course, they're trying to sideline American vehicles. And this is not going to be easy for General Motors. They make real money here. But we see China trying to sideline, for example, the entire soybean industry. They're trying desperately to build out their manufacturing in South America, putting in railroad tracks to be able to move the product from point A to point B. They're desperate to try and get this done. Desperate. They don't want to be buying American soybeans or hogs or, you know, how they feed their people because they don't want to support us. American farmers are the ones who are going to take that on the chin. They are now making their own vehicles, no matter how crappy they are or electric they are. Not that all electric vehicles are crappy by any stretch. It's just, you know, you can't force them down people's throats. They don't need the American vehicles, and soon they will stop the importation thereof. They used them when they needed them. So now they have to ask themselves, what's their plan? If you are talking about exiting markets that are not profitable, do you stay in China? That is working aggressively to make you not profitable. That's the question. So Corinne Jean-Pierre now is taking the podium. And they're supposed to address what this potential ceasefire or supposed alleged ceasefire agreement is.
Things over very quickly to my colleague, Admiral John Kirby, who will share more updates in the region.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Now, we're going to have to go to break here, but I will have it all for you when we get back. But I'm going to let Kirby play it out a little bit. This is Tony Katz today.
And we're discussing it with our partners in the region. Director Burns, as you know, is there, and he's working this in real time on the ground. I won't be able to comment any further on this until we know where things stand. I hope you can understand that. I know everybody's curious about what's in this response, what the Israeli reaction to it is. I'm just not going to get ahead of the process. We want to get these.
So we're not going to learn anything from John Kirby or the White House about this alleged deal, what it is Hamas is accepting from the Qataris and the Egyptians. More coming up. I'm Tony Katz.
Director Burns, as we speak, literally as you and I are talking, are having these conversations with partners in the region, it would be great. I'm sure we'd all like to have an answer as soon as possible, but I just don't want to get ahead of that process.
And a quick follow-up on the readout. When do you expect the Kerem Shalom crossing to reopen, or is it already reopened?
It should be open very, very soon. Prime Minister Netanyahu committed to opening it on the call this morning. So
this is John Kirby, National Security Communications Advisor, saying we have no comment on Hamas claiming they've accepted a proposal for a ceasefire. We have no data on the ceasefire agreement. We have no details on the ceasefire agreement. We have absolutely nothing to offer, so I'm just going to smile at you. But the idea that they're demanding that this crossing be open, Kerem Shalom it's called, this is where three Israeli Defense Forces soldiers were killed in an attack from Hamas, and there's now a demand that it be opened? Only in Israel, kids. Only in Israel. Tony Katz, Tony Katz Today. Good to be with you. Of course, this announcement that Hamas is accepting a deal. Well, we don't know what the deal is, and it all seems like a big push to not have the invasion from Israel into Rafah, thus ending Hamas once and for all, even though Hamas should be ended once and for all. I'm not really interested in what some student at Indiana University says. What do they know? They're students. They're children. They don't know anything. Oh, no, I get that they feel things, but what do they know? This is what makes the statement from Ben Sasse, the president of the University of Florida, so important. That Ben Sasse, former senator from Nebraska. Ben Sasse puts out an op-ed. The adults are still in charge at the University of Florida. Higher education has for years faced a slow-burning crisis of public trust. Mob rule at some of America's most prestigious universities in recent weeks have thrown gasoline on the fire. Pro-Hamas agitators have fought police, barricaded themselves in university buildings, shut down classes, forced commencement cancellations, and physically impeded Jewish students from attending lectures. One parent put it bluntly, why the hell should anybody spend their money to send their kid to college? At the University of Florida, we tell parents and future employers, we're not perfect, but the adults are still in charge. Our response to threats to build encampments is driven by three basic truths. And he goes through it, and you can find it at the Wall Street Journal. This is the way. And this isn't about Israel or Hamas. This is about a recognition that the college student is just that. It must bother college students to hear that they are not special, because after all, their parents and their teachers have told them they're special every day of their lives since forever. But you are not special. That doesn't mean you're bad. It means that you're not special. It means that your feelings are not more valuable than somebody else's. It does not mean that you feel more deeply than anybody else. It does not mean that you are more decent than anybody else or somehow more pious. It does not mean that you are somehow more touched with a secret knowledge other people just don't have. It means that you're 19 and you're a damn fool, and it's okay because most 19-year-olds are damn fools. Not all. I mean, some do join the military. See, that was a pro-military thing. And we got to admit, there are two sides of the bell curve. There are some people who join the military who are damn fools. But they're damn fools who at least love their country. All right, they're damn fools who thought that the military was the best opportunity for them. Either way, that's thinking. You on a college campus thinking that an encampment is the way to go are a damn fool. And you should be told so, because that's honest. It will help you. And what will it help you? Not be a damn fool in the future. Universities are run by the administrators. Universities are not run by the students. when Northwestern University, and I think Rutgers, decided to come to a deal with the protesters, they gave up. You send your kid to Northwestern or Rutgers or Columbia, you're so out of your head, you so hate your kid so damn much, it is hard to fathom. The student is never, ever, ever, ever in charge. The adults in the room are. The teachers, the professors, the administration, the board. But when students are told and taught that they are in charge by those professors, it is incumbent upon the university, incumbent upon the institution to remove those people. It is why I argue that all of these universities that have had this radicalness on their campuses start firing the professors who support it. They are not worth your time because they do not believe, as Ben Sasse has explained, this basic fundamental truth. The adults are still in charge because any professor who believes that students should act in such a way, call for genocide, and destroy the actual campus itself by the taking over of buildings or of quads or anything else, isn't worthy of being a professor there. Have a standard. Fire them. If the professor were to believe something differently than me, they are more than entitled to, and they're more than entitled to speak their piece. We're talking about pushing this as in a response. The professors who actually camped out with the students. They have no place on a campus and they provide no value. And any professor who believes in the eradication of a whole nation provides no value and should be fired. Let them go get a job at Berkeley. Indiana University and Columbia University and USC and UCLA and name another one should all grow up. The board should empower the president to get the job done. Clean house. But I want to say it again. It's not about Israel. We could pick 100 different subjects where the students think they're in charge. Wasn't it at what was the med school where they decided that the classes are too hard? Organic chemistry is tough. We should really change this. No, you shouldn't be a doctor. You know what separates the wheat from the chaff? Yeah, organic chemistry. You know what separates the good golfer from the great golfer from the PGA golfer? Putting. Drive for dough. Drive for show, putt for dough. Isn't that the expression, golfers? Now, the fact that you can't get it on the green in 2 or 3 if it's a par 5, well, that's one way. But those guys who can read the green and understand the curve and feel the weather and know the wind and take a look at their club and see the ball and see the cut of the grass and can put the physics together in order to get it to go in the cup, yeah, those guys are pros and everybody else is my neighbor. That's the difference. If you can't handle organic chemistry, you shouldn't be a doctor. Those Columbia students, it was the Columbia Law Review, you should pass everybody. Give everybody a passing grade. They shouldn't have to take finals. Everybody is irrevocably shook or irrevocably shaken. Shook, whatever the nonsense, millennial, Gen Z, nonsense, bullcrap phrase is. It changes daily, so who knows? Remember, we went from Latino and Latina to Latinx. And now Latin, L-A-T-I-N-E, because these people can never stop creating nonsense. If you think you shouldn't have to take finals because some other people were engaged in protest, you shouldn't be a lawyer. I wouldn't hire a Columbia lawyer. You got to be out of your mind to hire a Columbia lawyer. If they can't handle taking finals after what took place on their campus, how are they going to handle protecting you in a courtroom? It's a basic question. Ben Sasse and the University of Florida are absolutely correct. As he writes, universities must distinguish between speech and action. Speech is central to education. We're in the business of discovering knowledge and then passing it, both newly learned and time-tested, to the next generation. To do that, we need to foster an environment of free thought which ideas can be picked apart and put back together again and again. The heckler gets no veto. The best arguments deserve the best counterarguments. That gets followed by, to cherish the First Amendment rights of speech and assembly, we draw a hard line at unlawful action. Speech isn't violence. Silence isn't violence. Violence is violence. Second, writes Ben Sasse, universities must say what they mean and then do what they say. Empty threats make everything worse. Any parent who has endured a two-year-old's tantrum gets this. You can't say, don't make me come up there, if you aren't willing to walk up the stairs and enforce the rules. Appeasing mobs emboldens agitators everywhere. Moving classes online is a retreat that penalizes students and rewards protesters. Participating in live stream struggle sessions does not promote honest, good faith discussions. Ben Sasse, ladies and gentlemen. Read the whole piece. And be fully aware that there's a way to deal with these people. And it's not just on this subject of Israel and Hamas and Gaza. It's on all subjects. Adults must be in charge and students must be reminded that they are not special. They don't know more. If they did, they'd be the professors, but they aren't the professors. So stop thinking that you somehow know something that you don't. Sit in class, learn, and shut your mouth. Stop thinking you're special. Start thinking that you have something to learn. Then with the knowledge, you can go do things. The first university president that says to these people, why don't you transfer to Berkeley? There's no place for you here. They'll accept your nonsense. That's the university that everybody will flock to. There is going to be a conversation about the new Ivies. And it seems that the University of Florida desperately wants to be a part of that. I'm Tony Katz.
You don't want to get into the specifics here, but is it your understanding that this is Hamas's final offer? I mean, is there still room to negotiate here?
I think it's going to depend on our evaluation and the Israelis' evaluation of the response and where we go from here.
And as Steve mentioned, the Israelis are already warning people to evacuate Gaza. If they do go through with this operation, is the U.S. willing to consider putting limits or conditions on aid to Israel?
I won't get ahead of where we are right now, Mary, in the process here. And I'm certainly not going to speak to hypothetical operations that haven't happened yet. So I think we just have to see what transpires. The president was very direct. And consistently so this morning, that we don't want to see major ground operations in Rafah that put these people at greater risk.
But you know, a month ago, the administration did make clear that the U.S. would change its approach, right, if Israel didn't take significant steps to address the humanitarian crisis. Does that still hold? Is it possible that the U.S. could change course if the humanitarian process isn't improved?
Of course. We always have the right to adjust our policies as appropriate, and that has not changed, no.
And presumably an operation in Rafah would jeopardize steps to address the humanitarian.
All I can say is we've been very direct and very consistent in our views of concerns about operations in Rafah.
Yes, so much so that you stopped ammunition from being shipped to Israel, but we'll get to that another day. Tony Katz. Tony Katz today. Good to be with you. Madonna holds a concert. She's in Rio de Janeiro. And 1.6 million people show up. It was free. Which, you know, I guess is the only reason to go see Madonna in concert these days. You've seen some of the footage. It's not what we consider a she has not aged gracefully. Not what? Is that sexist? Because I want you to know right now, if that's sexist, I'm fine with it. She has not aged gracefully. What are we even thinking about discussing here? She has not said, hey, I can't do what I used to do. She says, hey, don't pay attention to age or reality. Look at me. And we're looking at you. And we're like, you're going to break a hip. we've looked at you, and then we said, we cannot unsee this. Literally saw you gyrating and then screamed out, my eyes, they burn, my eyes. 1.6 million people. The biggest show to date she ever had was 1987 in Paris. It was 130,000 people. But hey, I guess if people want to come out for a party, they're going to come out for a party. And in Rio de Janeiro, I think they like a good party. And then there was the whole Tom Brady roast. Did you see this? It was a live event on Netflix, and they're roasting Tom Brady. And, oh, and everybody's there. Bill Belichick's there, and Gronk is there. And Jeff Ross, who's the master of the roast. Kevin Hart was the host, but Jeff Ross is the guy. Tells a joke about Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, who's in the crowd, a massage joke. And then Tom Brady whispers in Jeff Ross's ear, don't say that you-know-what again. Tom, sit down. Robert Kraft is a big boy. He can handle it, okay? He doesn't need you to come to his defense. You're a guy who supposedly has a sense of humor. You can take all this ribbing. Just do it. You don't have to do a little Will Smith moment there. And then I saw that someone was saying that the Gen Zers thought that the roast was sexist and bigoted. Yeah, that's what a roast is. A roast is disgusting. A roast is basically a improv of the aristocrats joke. Just with like a lot of people all at once. That's what a roast is. So maybe it's not for you. Find everything at TonyKatz.com. Tomorrow, everyone. Take care.